All right, let's turn to chapter 10. Okay, chapter 10 through chapter 12 is one vision, one unit. So we call it the final vision. So capital A is the historical background to where he receives the prophecy that begins in chapter 11, verse 2. So from chapter 10, verse 1 to chapter 11, verse 1 is the vision of the man. The date of this last vision is the third year of Cyrus, in verse 1, makes it the year 536 BC. Daniel now is roughly between 84, 85 years old. And between chapter 9 and chapter 10, two more years have passed. And he points out a thing was revealed to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, and the thing was true, meaning it will be fulfilled. And what he saw is even a great warfare, a very long, strenuous period of troubles for Israel. And says he understood the thing, he had understanding of the vision. And the occasion by which the vision came to him is in verses 2 and 3. In those days I was mourning 3 whole weeks, in verse 2. It's been 2 years since the Jewish people were able to return to the land of Israel, but less than 50,000 people chose to return. And the exact numbers are found in Ezra chapter 2 and Nehemiah 7, Ezra 2, Nehemiah 7. So most of the Jewish people chose to stay behind in Babylonia because by then life had become good for them. Furthermore, we know from Ezra chapter 4, verses 1 through 5, Ezra 4, 1 through 5, there were difficulties in the land. The rebuilding of the temple had been hindered. On top of that, in Ezra chapter 4, verses 23 and 24, Ezra 4, 23 and 24, when they first came back, they laid down the foundation of the second temple. But because of opposition, it had been stopped, and 15 years will pass before they'll resume the reconstruction. So 15 years, the foundation lay there, but nothing more. So these are the elements that would have caused him to go to the period of mourning in verse 3. And so he says, he fasted, he ate no pleasant bread, no flesh wine in my mouth. He did not choose to undergo any relaxation, so he did not anoint his body with oil. And this lasted for 3 whole weeks, which included the week of Passover, because he could not observe Passover outside the land. And in the law, it says, Deuteronomy chapter 16, that they cannot observe the Passover outside the land of Israel. And furthermore, they can't even observe Passover everywhere in Israel, only where God put his name, which initially was Shiloh, but ultimately it was Jerusalem. And then the point two, we have the vision of the man in verses 4 through 6. The occasion is in verse 4. It was now the 24th day of the first month. And so the fast began after the new moon celebration, which lasts for 2 days. The fast continued to the completion of both the Feast of Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. He was by the side of the great river Hiddekel. Hiddekel is the Akkadian name for what we now call the Tigris River. But this time he's there physically, he's not there in vision like he was before. And then he gives a description of what he saw in verses 5 and 6. He was clothed in linen, emphasizing purity. It was also the kind of garments worn for priestly service. Secondly, his loins were girded with the pure gold of Uphaz. That shows a supernatural character, a mark of royalty. He had some kind of a princely rank or office in the angelic realm. Body was like beryl. meaning emphasizing perfection in health. Then fourthly, his face was as the appearance of lightning, emphasizing brilliance. He was reflecting the Shekinah glory. Fifthly, eyes as of flaming torches. He had penetrating insight, penetrating discernment. Arms and feet like burnished brass, a symbol of judgment. And the voice was like the voice of a multitude. Now, some assume that this was a vision of the Messiah based upon similarities with Revelation chapter 1, verses 13 through 16, but more likely he was merely a high-ranking angel because he would need the help of Michael, which the Messiah would not need anyone's help. And some verses 7 through 10.3 records Daniel's reaction. Verse 7 records the effect on Daniel. Only Daniel saw the vision, yet it was a very real appearance. And the people that were with Daniel as part of his escort did not see the vision, but they felt a great quaking that fell upon them, and they began to run away from something they didn't see, but felt, to hide themselves. And this is very similar to Paul's experience on the Damascus Road, where the other people with Paul didn't see anything, but they knew there was something supernatural happening. And that's in Acts 9, verses 3 through 7. Acts 9, verses 3 through 7. And verse 8 and 9 describes the effect it had on Daniel. I was left alone and saw the great vision. There made no strength in me. My comeliness was turned in me into corruption. I retained no strength, yet I heard the voice of his words, And when I heard the voice of his words, I was fallen into a deep sleep. He has trouble staying awake when angels talk to him. This is similar to what I experienced back in chapter 8, verses 17 and verse 18 and verse 27. So verse 10, the angel touches him, and this is the first time he touches him. There'll be more than once. Set me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hand. He was now in a kneeling position. And in verse 11 through 14, we have the message of the man. Verse 11 provides the reason for the angelic touch. And the statement is from the angel, O Daniel, you man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto you. Stand upright, meaning stand up from his kneeling position. For unto you am I now sent. And Daniel responded in verse 11, he stood up, but he stood up trembling. And then the angel describes an angelic conflict that happened, something, and this happens multiple times, but we cannot see this happening. In verse 12, the angel says to Daniel, from the first day that Daniel had begun his fast, the day that Daniel set his heart to understand the reason for the problems back in the land, the day he began to humble himself before his God, Daniel's words were heard, and the angel came to answer Daniel's prayer. But why did it take him 3 weeks to get to Daniel? The reason for the delay is in verse 13. He was withstood by the prince of the kingdom of Persia for 21 days. And here we have the existence of a high fallen angel. Because when the angels fell at the time of the satanic fall, you had angels falling, you had seraphim falling, you had cherubim falling, and so you had categories of all three angelic beings falling with Satan. So this is a high fallen angel, and Satan has this hierarchy by which he uses to thwart the purpose of God, especially in relationship to Israel. And there's a category of angelic beings known as chief princes, and chief princes are in charge of a nation, not so much in charge of a nation, but so much to influence the nation one way or the other. And there are holy chief princes, was also fallen chief princes. The fallen chief princes tried to make governments move against the people of Israel, while the holy chief princes, of which Michael is one, tried to get the governments to favor policy towards Israel, towards the Jewish people. And so he was held back for 3 whole weeks, couldn't break through until Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. Now, Michael biblically has 2 offices. First of all, he is an archangel. There is only 1 archangel, and this archangel means he's the head of all the angels. As was referred to in Jude verse 9, Revelation chapter 12, verse 7. He's also a chief prince, and there are several chief princes, both fallen and unfallen. And he's a chief prince specifically over Israel, as we see from verse 21 of this chapter, and again in chapter 12, verse 1. It says, I remained there with the kings of Persia. Literally, the Hebrew word means to become superfluous. Now that Michael had arrived, he was no longer needed. I was left over there besides the kings, had nothing more to do. And so now he's free to begin moving towards Daniel. And the purpose of his coming in verse 14 is to make you understand what shall befall your people in the latter days. In essence, Daniel was to be informed of the future of the Jews, particularly of the latter days, though he'll also give him quite a bit of prophecies about the near future, as well as the ultimate future. It says, for the vision is yet for many days. There'll be a long time will pass before the vision will be fulfilled. Now, Dan's reaction to his first conversation with this angel is in verses 15 through 19.5. In verse 15, notice the effect on Daniel. I set my face to the ground. I was dumb or mute. He was reduced to a sense of weakness, which led to the second angelic touch in verse 16. This time the touch specifically on his lips. And Daniel issues some protests in verses 16 and 17. He says, Oh my Lord, by reason of the vision, my sorrow is turned upon me. I retain no strength. For how can the servant of this, my Lord, talk with this, my Lord? For as for me, straightway there remains no strength in me, neither is there any breath in me. Use the word Lord 3 times, but it's not the word Adonai, which would be a reference to God, but the Adoni, which is a non-theistic statement. And so verse 18, he gets the third angelic touch. As a result of this third angelic touch, he's much more strengthened. An angelic comfort is in verse 19, O man greatly beloved, a total of 3 times, as he referred to this way in this prophecy. Fear not, peace be unto you, be strong, yea, be strong. And indeed it works. At the end of verse 19, Daniel is strengthened. He said, Let my Lord speak, if you have strengthened me, I'm not strong enough to hear what you have to say. So point 6, we have the message of the man from chapter 10, verse 20, down through chapter 11, verse 1. And he raises the question, Do you understand why I've come to you? Now I'll return to fight with the prince of Persia. After he fulfills his mission to Daniel, he will continue his warfare with the prince of Persia in order to maintain the position and advantage already gained in verse 13. And so this angel was, this chief angel that was talking to Daniel had been winning. And so Cyrus had issued a decree for the Jews to be allowed to return and build a city and build a temple. And now that Michael has stepped in to fight with the prince of Persia temporarily, he's able to go give his message to Daniel and now go back and take over the battle. Because for now, there's a 15-year warfare that's already begun to keep the Jews from restoring Jerusalem and building the temple. So now he'll go back and take over where Michael has left off to continue the battle till they finally get full ability and permission to get the completion of the temple to be built. And he says in verse 20, when I go forth, lo, the prince of Greece shall come. And when Greece becomes dominant, the Jews will fall under the Hellenistic sway. At that point, the prince of Persia is not an issue anymore. And from then on, there'll be a struggle with the prince of Greece. And those, as I mentioned, that struggle is ongoing with different governments, not every government necessarily, because these chief princes, especially with governments that have some influence either negatively against Israel or positively for Israel. In verse 21, he points out he will have the help of Michael. I will tell you that which is inscribed in the writing of truth. The writing of truth is the book up in heaven. The book up in heaven is out of which the scriptures are produced. And what we have in the Bible is just one segment of a much larger book in heaven. And it says, there's none that holds with me against these but Michael, your prince. Again, notice Michael is your prince, Daniel's prince, the prince of Israel. Michael is in charge of Israel, and he's the one who is assigned to battle Satan's emissaries over nations under whom Israel is found. So at this point in Daniel's life, is still the prince of Persia, later will be the prince of Greece. So this one, whenever he needs it, can call upon Michael for help. And this authority was described for him in the writing of truth. So the background is not in our scriptures, but it's part of the scriptures of heaven, the much larger book. And so he's got the authority to fight against these, the prince of Persia now, the prince of Greece in the future. In chapter 11, verse 1, you now also have the help of Michael. As for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, this is the year 539 BC, this was 2 years earlier, when Darius the Mede was king over the province of Babylonia, when Cyrus the Great was the emperor of the whole empire, I stood to confirm and strengthen him, meaning Michael. So he once helped Michael in getting the movement 2 years ago, and Michael now helps this angel, as this angel once helped him. As describing a spiritual conflict to turn Darius and Cyrus to a pro-Jewish stance, which is what they do in chapter 6 of Daniel. So Michael the archangel and this higher angel, chief prince, provide mutual assistance for each other. They did so 2 years earlier, and they can do so again. And because they did so 2 years earlier is why the decree was issued, to let the Jews return and the city and the temple to be rebuilt. And with that background, we come to capital B, the prophecy from chapter 11, verse 2 to chapter 12, verse 4. And he begins with Persia, which is what's in power at the time that that was already in place 2 years ago, and still in power. And here the message proper actually begins. Here's the beginning of the prophecy. It says, behold, there shall yet stand up 3 kings in Persia. Now turn forward till you have the list of the Persian kings. That'll be page 11. There shall yet stand out 3 kings in Persia, meaning 3 kings will arise after Cyrus the Great. So Cyrus the Great on your sheet and bottom part, verse page 11, ruled from 539 to 530 BC. And then three kings that will come after him is point number two, Cambyses from 530 to 522. He was the son of Cyrus. He's mentioned under the name of Ahasuerus in Ezra chapter 4, verse 6. Ezra 4, verse 6. And he committed suicide. The second king after Cyrus will be Pseudo-Smerdes in 522. He's the Artaxerxes of Ezra chapter 4, verse 7, Ezra chapter 4, verse 7. Smerdes was the actual true king, but this one pretended to be Smerdes, that's why the Pseudo-Smerdes. And the next one after the third one in the list will be Darius the First Hystaspes in 522 to 486. He's mentioned Ezra chapter 4, verse 24. It is unto him they're able to resume the rebuilding of the temple. And it's during his rule that you have the rise of two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, with the prophets when he was the emperor. Now he's not saying there'll only be only three kings after Cyrus, only three kings will follow before Cambyses. This me, number five, Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, who launches his major war against Greece. So here we're dealing with Xerxes the First. This is also the Ahasuerus of the Book of Esther. And he was the one that became the husband of Esther. It says, shall be richer than they all. He'll bring the height of Persia to the height of its power. When he waxed strong through his riches, he amassed tremendous wealth to his conquests of Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. He had a very heavy taxation program that he inherited from Darius the First Hystaspes. An example of his wealth is that he could throw a 180-day festival for many people, which is what he does in Esther chapter 1, verses 1 through 12. And he says, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. He spent 4 years amassing an army of 2.5 million men. That included both army and navy. And he began his expedition against Greece in 480 BC. And this expedition against Greece occurs between chapters 1 and 2 of the Book of Esther. Between chapters 1 and 2 of the Book of Esther. Also began the decline of the Persian Empire. Towards the latter part of his reign, he was murdered. And your list here has all the other kings thereafter, which does not affect anything in the prophecy here. But as far as the prophecy here, it goes. That's about as far as it goes. Let's go back to your main outline. Now I come to point two, which is Greece in verses 3 and 4 of chapter 11. And verse 3 deals with Alexander the Great. And so he says, a mighty king shall stand up. Stand up emphasizes a military term. He shall rule with great dominion. He ruled the time of his death, he ruled from Egypt in the west all the way to India in the east. He shall do according to his will until his untimely death. And then in verse 4, again, he deals with division of the four and division into four divisions. We shall stand up, again a military term, when Alexander reaches the height of his power, his kingdom shall be broken. And again, he died in a drunken stupor. His kingdom will be divided towards the four winds of heaven. And again, the four divisions we talked about previously. He also specifies not to his posterity, because not didn't go to any one of his own sons. He had two sons. One was named Hercules, not the famous one, but Hercules. He was an illegitimate son that he sired through the daughter of Darius III. And this son was murdered in the year 309. He had a second son named Alexander, same as his name, and that was born of another woman named Roxana, and this son was also murdered in the year 310. The only other blood relative that could inherit the empire was Philip, who was the half-brother of Alexander the Great, but he was murdered in the year 317. And that's why the four generals were then able to divide the empire for themselves. But he points out, not according to his dominion, wherewith he ruled, none of his successors ever extended the kingdom to Alexander's extent. And again, each only had a portion of the empire to rule. For his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those. Those refers to Alexander's son, and the others are the generals. Now, the initial decision that the generals had made is that the two sons should rule as co-monarchs, with others making the decisions until they came of age, because they were quite young. But this agreement among the generals caused them to delay the decision, and finally led to a conflict that had the two sons killed, and therefore they divided the empire among themselves. Now we come to a rather detailed element which I'll not try to work through. And that's under point 3, the conflict between the Ptolemies of Egypt and the Seleucids of Syria. The prophecies are rather exact. Oops. Satan pushed my Bible again. Because of such details, and the details were fulfilled, but it's kind of going throughout almost a monotonous way to try to talk about it. So I'm going to skip the section between verses 5 to 20. Because it'd be rather slow going, and I don't have the necessary overheads to be able to bring this off. But just to say, in these passages, what you have is the conflicts between the kingdom of Syria and the kingdom of Egypt, the Seleucids of Syria and the Ptolemies of Egypt, and what the results in this what becomes the battleground. Now, initially, the land of Israel fell under Egypt, and the Greek Egyptians were not particularly zealous in pushing Hellenism, so as long as the Jewish people paid their taxes to Egypt and so on, they allowed to practice their Judaism. But the Seleucids of Egypt were much more aggressive in making people and forcing people to adopt Hellenism. And so when Israel fell under the Seleucids, under Syria, they were having problems. And the worst one, as you turn to page 9 of your outline, point number 4, the same one we saw back in chapter 8, we see again, Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, verses 21 to 24 describe his rise to power. And in verse 21, he describes him usurping the throne. In his place, in place of the previous king, Seleucus IV Philopater, shall stand up a contemptible person, and that would be Antiochus IV Epiphanes, to whom they had not given the honor of the kingdom. It meant he was not the rightful heir. The rightful heir was a man named Demetrius Soter. But he says, he shall come in time of security. Antiochus, at this point of time, was in Athens. When he heard his brother had been murdered, young Antiochus, the rightful heir, was being held as a hostage in Rome, was to become the new king. Antiochus Epiphanes then came to Antioch. He was pretending to be the legal guardian of the boy that was supposed to become the king. It says, you shall obtain the kingdom by flatteries. He obtained the throne by means of intrigue. He received support from the king of Pergamum by using flattery. And so he arranged for the young Antiochus, who was the rightful heir, to be murdered. And the guy he hired to murder the young child did the job. He killed the child, but then Antiochus had his name was Andronicus, also killed. So that was the witness that could be against Antiochus Epiphanes. So having removed the main heir, in verse 22 began the consolidation of power. And he says, an overwhelming force shall be overwhelmed, from before him shall be broken. Here you have the flood figure, meaning a military conquest. And what this was Egyptian troops moving now through the land of Israel to try to put Israel back under Egyptian sovereignty. Here also the Prince of the Covenant. The Prince of the Covenant was the high priest, who was the leader of the theocracy. And so Antiochus Epiphanes did, as we said before, he removed Onias III, and later had Onias III assassinated by means of his own brother. So now the new high priests were all pro-Hellenism and not believing priests. And in verse 23, we have a description of the growth of his strength. After a league he made with Egypt and others. Now he had a sister that married one of the Egyptian princes. And when this Egyptian prince became the king of Egypt, he assumed that his sister, which not the Cleopatra that was famous later on, but also the same name, Cleopatra, she would not side with her brother, Antiochus Epiphanes, but with her husband. And therefore he lost her help. So he says, he shall work deceitfully. Because at this point in Egypt, there were two different brothers that were eyeing for the throne. And Antiochus IV decided to support one brother against the other. So he says, he shall come up, he shall become strong through deceit with a small people, much smaller than what his father's, Antiochus III. And in verse 24, he grew in wealth. It was a time of security. He shall come even upon the fattest pieces of the province. The fattest places is the fertile country. He would attack without warning. He would seize produce. And he raided the whole areas of the province. He shall do which his fathers have not done, nor his father's fathers. His fathers plundered, but they used money for luxurious living. But this one decided to gather the money for the purpose of raising a large army. He wanted desperately to retake Egypt. And so, he says, even for a time, he worked on gathering his army for 12 years. And now he felt he was ready, and there, small b, we have the first Egyptian campaign in verses 25 to 28. In verses 25 to 26, he was with Egypt. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. The king of the south is Ptolemy the sixth. This was one of the two sons of Cleopatra, so this Ptolemy happened to be Antiochus' nephew. And once again, he wants to defeat Egypt and control Israel, which was given to someone else. So he attacks Egypt in the year 170 BC. And he says, the king of the south shall war in battle with an exceeding great and mighty army. The battle was fought in northern Sinai, but he shall not stand. Ptolemy the sixth lost the war and was captured. For they shall devise devices against him. And one reason why Ptolemy lost this battle is because of treachery within his own ranks. Yea, they that ate of his dainties shall destroy him. His trusted counselors were the ones who betrayed him. And his army shall overflow. Ptolemy's army shall be overflowing in size, but many shall fall down slain. And overflowing numbers, many of these are actually killed and fall in death. Well, the other brother now takes over Egypt, while the one that was captured is now captured in the hands of Antiochus Epiphanes. So verse 27, there's now intrigue between Antiochus Epiphanes and Ptolemy the sixth. He says, their hearts shall be to do mischief. And the people, what the people of Alexandria in Egypt did was make their brother the official king. Make their brother the official king. So what Antiochus did, he pretended to be a friend of Ptolemy the sixth, hoping in this way to gain all of Egypt by promising to get Ptolemy the sixth back on the throne. And says they shall speak lies at one table. And Antiochus pretended to desire to conquer Egypt to put Ptolemy the sixth back on the throne. And Ptolemy the sixth pretended to believe him. But it shall not prosper. The common plan failed. Antiochus only succeeded in making Ptolemy the sixth the king of Memphis, but not the whole, all of Egypt, and not the main city, Alexandria. And so Antiochus left not fully in control of Egypt as he wanted to be. It says, for the end shall be at the time appointed, meaning the appointed time for the end of the north-south war had not yet happened. In verse 28, he returns to Syria. But as he returns to Syria, he goes to the land of Israel, and his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant. Holy Covenant is the theocracy under the high priest. And he shall do his pleasure and return to his own land. The details of what happens here are in 1 Maccabees chapter 1 and 2 Maccabees chapter 5. 1 Maccabees 1, 2 Maccabees chapter 5. What he does in his return to Syria, he kills 80,000 men, women, and children. And he takes 40,000 Jews into slavery. Now, historically, there's also a second Egyptian campaign, which Daniel does not deal with, but under small c, now deals with a third Egyptian campaign in verses 29 and 30. At the appointed time, he shall return and come to the south. This is his third campaign in the year 168 BC. The second campaign happened in 169, which Daniel does not deal with. Well, he went for the time appointed, but he doesn't know it's appointed by God. He learned of the agreement the two brothers had made, and he felt betrayed by Ptolemy VI. So he goes against Egypt now for the third time, but Daniel says it shall not be in the latter time as it was in the former. He will not have the victory he had previously. And the reason is, for the ships of Kittim shall be against them. Kittim is Cyprus, and also a term used for the territory west of Israel. And the ships that the Rentians were Roman galleys that came to Egypt from Cyprus. And as he was marching close to Alexandria to be able to capture the capital city at long last, which he could not do in the first and second campaign, he was met by the Roman general, and the Roman general ordered him to leave Egypt immediately. Well, Titus Epiphanes decided, told the general, he wanted to consult with his advisors. So what the Roman general did was pull out a sword and drew a circle around where Antiochus Epiphanes was standing. And he was told, make your decision before you leave the circle. Antiochus Epiphanes didn't realize he could not handle with Rome, so he does withdraw. And that leads to the events of the Maccabees and so on, and under small d, the persecution of the Jews in verses 30 through 35, with 30 and 31 dealing with the persecution. So in verse 30, therefore shall he be grieved. He was now repelled by Rome, and now he'll take it out on the Jews. And shall return, and Israel was on, as Israel was on the way back to Syria, he decided to have indignation against the Holy Covenant. Indignation against the Holy Covenant, the theocracy, indignation, his anger against the Jews, as if they had any reason to be blamed for his failures. He shall do his pleasure. He'll carry out his program against the Jews. He shall even return. He'll come to Israel again. And have regard to them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Again, there was a segment of the Jewish population that were known as Hellenizers. And these were the Jewish apostates who were promoting Hellenism and over against Judaism. What happens here is also detailed as far as fulfillment in 2 Maccabees chapter 4. 2 Maccabees chapter 4. In verse 31, you have again the account, his account of his abomination of desolation. It says, forces shall stand up. They'll have, he would have the help of the apostate Jews, the Hellenizers, and they shall profane the sanctuary. What happened is that they took over the temple compound on a Sabbath day and they offered a pig on the holy altar. And they took over the fortress which guarded the temple compound. And they shall take away the continual burnt offerings. He now removed, stopped the sacrificial system. It says he set up the abomination that makes desolate. What he did was put up an image of Zeus Olympus or Jupiter and offered pigs to Jupiter. Issued the ruling, the observance of the Sabbath was now prohibited. He also had sent soldiers into the temple compound to perform different sexual rites and practices inside the temple compound. The details here are 1 Maccabees 1, 1 Maccabees 1, 2 Maccabees 6. 2 Maccabees 6. In verses 32 to 35, we have the response of the Jewish forces. Now, verse 32, the policy of Antiochus IV Epiphanes, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he pervert by flatteries. Such as do wickedly against the covenant with the apostate Jewish people, and he shall pervert with flatteries. He pits one group against another. He deliberately favors and elevates those who became Hellenizers. And that led in verse 32 to 35 to the revolt of the Maccabees. In verse 32, the people that know their God shall be strong and do exodus. The people that know their God, these were the Maccabees, they shall be strong in the Lord. They shall do exploits. Eventually, the Maccabees defeat every army that Antiochus sends against them. And all the details about all these armies you'll find in 1 Maccabees chapters 2 through chapter 13. Chapter 2 through chapter 13. Now, verse 33 talks about another group besides the Maccabees, which we know as the Hasidim, H-A-S-I-D-I-M, H-A-S-I-D-I-M, no correlation to the modern Hasidim. They that were wise among the people shall instruct many. So in spite of the decree against teaching Torah, the righteous continue to teach the way of the Lord. Yet they shall fall, and many will die by persecution over many days, by means of sword, flame, captivity, and sword. The Hasidim had a policy which is what destroyed them, their policy of not fighting on the Sabbath day. And when the Greeks learned that, they attacked them only on the Sabbath day, and because they would not fight back on the Sabbath day, they ceased to exist. But the Maccabees had a different policy. For the sake of life, they can fight on the Sabbath day. Now, verse 34 comes back and describes the fall of the Maccabees. Now, when they shall fall, meaning when the Hasidim fall, they shall be helped with a little help. The Maccabees succeed in freeing Israel from the Syrians. But none of the five Maccabee brothers died of natural causes. Three died in battle, including Judah Maccabee, and two died by treachery. And the last of the Maccabees, Simon Maccabee, was the firstborn, was poisoned by his son-in-law. You can't trust those in-laws. But it says, many shall join themselves unto it flatteries. Many actually preferred Hellenism when they saw the Maccabean successes joined with the Maccabees only because of convenience, not because of true faith. And later, after the five brothers died, what happened was they had the descendants of Simon Maccabee ruling king after king, and they became the zealous Hellenizers thereafter. Now, verse 35 then provides the divine purpose for the persecution. Some of them that shall rise shall fall. That was true with the Hasidim, that was true with the Maccabees. But the purpose is to refine them, purify them, to make them white. Now, as we saw in chapter 8, you move from Antiochus Epiphanes to the Antichrist, and everything you go through verse 35 was literally fulfilled in the life of Antiochus Epiphanes. But now in verse 36, notice a transitional statement. Verse 35, right then to verse 35. And some of them, they are wise, shall they refine them and to purify and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it's yet for the time appointed. And so you have a transitional statement again. In this transitional statement, you move from the near prophecy now fulfilled to future prophecy yet to be fulfilled. So again, verses 2 through 35 historically were quite literally fulfilled, which is where a lot of scholars claim that Daniel wasn't written at the time that he says it was written. It was written in the first century when all these things were already history. But it's just an assumption that prophecy cannot exist. But verses 36 to 45 has never been fulfilled. And I was reading a commentary in Daniel, which was written by an Amil, meaning someone that does not take the Bible literally and so on as far as the future events. And this commentator says, In short, while it's true that Antiochus fulfills in a Jiangwei description given in these verses, there are discrepancies when it comes to the ethics regarding his religious practices. And so this commentator admits up to verse 35, everything was fit literally, but verses 36 was only fulfilled in a general way because he does not believe in the future kingdom. That's the conclusion. So point five, we now come to the Antichrist in verses 36 to 45, and we begin with his nature and rise to power in verses 36 to 39. So verse 36, the rise of the willful king. The king shall do according to his will. He'll be characterized by willfulness. He shall exalt himself above humanity. He shall magnify himself against every god. He'll claim deity for himself. And Paul emphasizes this in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4, 2 Thess 2, 3 and 4, Revelation 13, verses 1 through 8, Revelation 13, verses 1 through 8. He shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods. Same thing he does back in chapter 7, verse 25. He shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. Indignation is the great tribulation, as will affect the Jewish population of that day. He shall prosper as long as the indignation lasts. Until the indignation be accomplished. And that will, his indignation will last for exactly 3.5 years. He says, that which is determined shall be done. Determined means it's decreed, irrevocable. God has already decreed he'll only be able to allow to rule for 3.5 years and persecute the Jews for 3.5 years. It won't be allowed to go 1 second beyond that. And that which is determined shall be done. Determined is decreed and irreversible. The nation is decreed and irrevocable. Duration is decreed and irrevocable. Now the nature of the willful king in verse 37, neither shall regard the gods of his fathers. If you read in King James, it says the God, capital G-O-D. And people have used that phrase. This shows that he will be a Jew because he does not regard the God of his fathers. All the other translations have corrected that because in this whole section, when you see the word God, it's always in the singular, not in the plural, always in the singular. The only time it's used in the plural is right here in verse 37. And the context shows he's not referring to the true God, he's referring to the pagan gods. And so the ASV and other translations have rendered it correctly, he shall not regard the gods of his fathers. So the reference is to pagan gods, not the true God. And it points again to Gentile origin of the willful king. But he repudiated the gods of his Gentile ancestors, nor the desire of women. Literally means he will have no regard for that which women desire. It's not referring, as often interpreted, to a Jewish mother's desire to become the mother of the Messiah. But rather, because he's a member of the Nephilim, and Nephilim were basically sexless, and therefore will not have the desire for women. He will not desire for the love of women, nor he'll be inhumane in regard to women. Nor regard any god, the true or the false. He shall magnify himself above all, above men, above women. And in verse 38, notice what the religion of the willful king will be. In this place he shall honor the god of fortresses, while he worship is might and power, for might makes right. And a god whom his fathers knew not, he shall honor. He will worship Satan. With gold, silver, precious stone, pleasant things. And the policy of the willful king is in verse 39. He shall deal with the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. His ability comes, notice, to conquer is not from his own power, but he has received supernatural power. He shall deal with strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god. This foreign god will be Satan. And this is verified in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 8 through 10, 2 Thess 2, 8 through 10. Also in more detail, Revelation 13, verses 1 through 8, Revelation 13, verses 1 through 8. To those who acknowledge him, who confess him to be God, will be rewarded for their loyalty. So he'll increase with glory, the status will be elevated. He shall cause them to rule over many. Those who worship him will be given positional elevation, more authority. He shall divide the land for a price. He'll divide conquered territory for a price, those who are loyal to the Antichrist, those who are willing to take his mark of 666. Okay, we're a good stopping point, and then we can finish the rest of it in the last hour. And also, there'll be time for questions thereafter.